Our Bible reading this morning is from Matthew chapter 27, verse 57 to Matthew chapter 28, verse 15. You can find it printed on the inside of your cream-coloured sheet, or there's also some Bibles at the end of your seats there if you'd like to grab one. Before we read, please pray with me. Father God, thank you that the news of what you have done for us to save us from the punishment for our sin has been faithfully passed down to us through the generations. As we read from Matthew's account of the resurrection this morning, please help us to understand it afresh and respond rightly to it. Please help us to concentrate as we read and as Ian teaches us from Matthew this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. So Matthew chapter 27 verse 57 to Matthew 28 verse 15. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who also was a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. And Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. Next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was alive, 'After 3 days, I will rise.' Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can." So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here, he has risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead. And behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him again. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy, and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While they were going, behold, some of the guards went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and said, as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day.
Thanks, Dave. Well, it's Easter. And very happily, can we go back one, please, Roland? That's it. Very happily for us, Matthew has given us a couple of Easter eggs to help us get a grip on what's going on. You know what I mean by Easter eggs, don't you? Not the chocolate kind done for us by Lindt in Switzerland, love them as we may. I mean the digital kind. Locked into this passage from Matthew, there are two of those kinds of Easter eggs waiting for us to stumble over them. You know the kind of thing. You have a DVD or a computer game, and on a particular date or when you enter a special bit of code, out pops something that wasn't advertised and that you never knew was there before. A bit of video footage or a character or a cheat in the game or something like that, hidden digitally by the manufacturers and lying dormant until you enter the right thing or ask the right question. That's what Matthew's got. And it's even more like that than you would think for something from the first century. After all, Matthew might be writing in the first century, but it is almost a digital recording that he's given us. What do I mean by that? Well, think about it. If you're stuck in the first century and you want to send a message to people in the 21st, what are your options? You can tell someone. You can tell someone to tell someone to tell someone to tell someone. Oh, that's great. You know, you tell your friend Bilbo, when it was evening there came a rich man from Arimathea. He's heard you and he passes it on, but it's an analogue recording. And every time it gets passed on, it gets a little bit more garbled. Bilbo tells Frodo, Frodo tells Sam, Sam tells Merry, Merry tells Pippin. And the message that Pippin gets, or thinks he gets, because Pippin isn't all that brilliant about this kind of thing, the message that Pippin gets is, when it was breathing, a bear became a bridgeman from Armenia. You know, if you are stuck in the first century, you'll be lucky to get past the 200-year mark with your spoken words making any kind of sense. Let alone manage to hide an Easter egg inside them. It's a worry. But if you're in the first century, you've got one way of recording that is almost digital. You can write. You can write, and you get copies made of what you write, and copies are made of copies. Your original bit of papyrus doesn't last, but that doesn't matter. Because the way you copy writing until the invention of the photocopier is almost digital. Someone copies it out, letter by letter. And like a CD drive, they don't even have to understand what they're copying, they just need to copy it accurately. Change a letter or two in when it was evening, and you might get something like, Bennett what evening? But then you compare it to a few other copies, and you can soon spot where a mistake has crept in. And you can correct it. So even 20 centuries later, you can pick up Matthew's Gospel, and you haven't got something with a whopping great 20th century gap between you and Matthew. You've got pretty much his words in high fidelity. In English maybe, but pretty much his words. So hopefully with an almost digital system, his Easter eggs will still work. But before we can try them out, we've got a problem that 20 centuries have introduced. It's the problem with having a book that has been knocking around in religious places for so long. Matthew is covered with barnacles. What do I mean? Well, if you leave your boat moored in the sea for too long, barnacles will land on it and grow. If you have a jetty in the sea for too long, barnacles will land on it and grow. And if you need your ship to be fast, your barnacles can be a real problem. They slow you down. You have to come ashore from time to time and chip them off. They used to tell us in primary school that good old William Dampier beached his ship on the coast of Australia to knock his barnacles off. Nowadays he'd use acid or poisonous paint or something like that. My favourite for dealing with barnacles is still a hammer and a blunt chisel. To get the barnacle off in one piece and take a good look at it, although I understand these are not recommended for using on the hulls of fiberglass boats. Now that is ships and things in the sea. But you leave a book like Matthew's Gospel submerged in religion for too long, and all these barnacles start growing over it, so that the almost digital recording is still fine, but you don't get to see the Easter eggs. You try fitting that into your CD drive. You scrape off the barnacles first. It's tradition and folklore and myths and wacky ideas, those kinds of barnacles. And they are such big barnacles that they can stop us from seeing what Matthew says. So, to get at Matthew, it helps to scrape off, we'll chisel off a few barnacles first. First barnacle problem is easy. That is up there in verse 57. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was a disciple of Jesus. Now, poor Joseph of Arimathea is covered in a pile of very patriotic English barnacles. According to the barnacles, Joseph of Arimathea made his way over to Britain to work over the natives. And to help him do the business, he brought two prize pieces of equipment: the spear a Roman soldier used to stab Jesus, and even better than that, the Holy Grail. Oh, the descendants of Joseph become custodians of the Holy Grail, and they squat in secret in magical castles all over England until Arthur sends his knights on a little grail hunt. These are fantastic English barnacles. And they give the Brits a little piece of a Bible character to call their own, and they work wonders for the Glastonbury tourist industry. Now, we can date the barnacles very easily. They started growing in the middle 1200s when the first version of this book, The Quest of the Holy Grail, was written. What if we chisel the barnacles off? So we've got Joseph the way that Matthew gives us to him. What have we got then? Well, Joseph is rich and he's from a town north of Jerusalem. And he's a disciple. In verse 58 and 59, he steps in to make sure that Jesus is not left on the cross or thrown into a mass grave. In verse 60, he has Jesus buried in his own tomb. Now you have to admire Joseph's courage. He goes in verse 58 to the Roman governor to ask for the body of a political criminal. This would take some doing. Without the barnacles, we see him as an enthusiast for Jesus who wants to try and do the right thing by him if he can. And in verse 60, it is the kind of tomb that can be closed by rolling a stone across the entrance. There are more barnacles to follow. Those guards down in verse 66 have got a case of them. Somewhere in the imagination, when we read about the guards, there's this mental picture of a squad of Roman legionaries in armour standing guard over Jesus' tomb, alert as anything, and then being bought off afterwards. Now, these are Roman barnacles. But then look at what happens. Verse 62. The priests approach Pilate the Roman. And in 63, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said while he was still alive, 'After 3 days I will rise.'" The priests have a lot of intelligence on Jesus. They have argued with him themselves, and they are well aware of the kinds of things that Jesus has been saying. So, and this is amazing, they start giving orders to Pilate. Verse 64. "Therefore, order the tomb to be secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he is risen from the dead." Well, now you think about this from Pilate's point of view. You are up to here with these priests. In the last few days, they have hauled this obscure and apparently harmless prophet up in front of you on fake charges. You, Pilate, you could see it was a setup, but when you try to get Jesus off the hook, these same priests do their bit to work the crowd to howl for his blood. And you, Pilate the politician, you disgrace yourself by condemning a man you know is innocent. You do it to avoid a riot. You do it to keep the Roman peace. You do it because you care more about keeping things stable than you care about right and wrong. You do it because you are cornered by these jolly Jewish priests. And now they come wittering on about some vague superstitious tale of Jesus saying that he would rise, and they start telling you what to do. Are you going to put Roman legionaries under the command of these wretched priests? Verse 65, Pilate says, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go and make it as secure as you can." That is Pilate. You throw the ball back to the priests. They have their own soldiers. Not Romans, temple guards. A sort of priestly security firm. Pilate tells them to use those guards. And then you see their quality tested. In 28 verse 4, at the first sign of trouble, they all fall over in a heap. In 28 verse 15, they are bribed. Now, it's funny, the story in verse 13 that they're supposed to tell is that they were asleep and the disciples came and nicked Jesus' body. If they were really asleep, you would wonder how they were supposed to know who nicked it. And even better than that, if they really were Roman soldiers, sleeping on duty brings a court-martial and a death penalty. And in verse 14, there is no way that the priests would have the leverage with Pilate to avoid a thing like that. But the word translated governor in verse 13 should be commanding officer. The commanding officer of the temple guards isn't Pilate, it's another priest. And it's easy for these high priests to fix that. And in the old Jewish books that talk about these temple guards, the penalty for a temple guard falling asleep on duty was either being beaten up or having his clothes set on fire. That was supposed to wake him up, you see. Such is life. The guard barnacles don't bother us much if we've got a decent translation like this one. But the last two sets of barnacles are more of a problem. Look at verse 61. At Jesus' burial, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary? A few verses before, just before the bit that's printed in verse 56, we're told that the other Mary is Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. Which Mary is that? Well, try chapter 13. In Jesus' hometown, this is what the people say. "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? Are not his brothers James and Joseph? Are not his sisters with us?" Mary, the mother of James and Joseph, is almost certainly the Mary we meet in chapter 1. Jesus' own mother. And to have both her and Mary Magdalene together in verse 61, these are the two misunderstood and misrepresented women in history, I think. This is Barnacle City. Most of the barnacles on Mary Magdalene are goose barnacles. You'd have to be a goose to take them seriously. What we know about her in real life is dead simple. She is one of Jesus' early followers. Luke says that Jesus cast 7 demons out of her. Whatever that may mean for her personally before she met Jesus, it really doesn't sound good. Later on, she was there when Jesus was executed, and she was there when he returned to life, which makes her a witness to the key events in Jesus' history. And this one, the day Jesus returns to life, this is the big one that gets told about her for 400 years after the event. Now, 200 years after her life, the barnacles start. There is an obscure little scribbler on the banks of the Nile who writes some cryptic comment under the assumed name of Philip. 500 years later, after her life, Gregory the Great decides on the basis of no information whatsoever that she was a prostitute. 1,000 years after her life, a French book has her turning up in France, living in a cave and being buried in Provence, or maybe Constantinople. But she gets about, doesn't she? And of course, more than 1900 years after her life, Dan Brown makes a major money spinner out of having her have a daughter by Jesus. Now that is a goose barnacle of amazing size. But you scrape off the barnacles, and this is Mary Magdalene's great moment in history. Verse 9, meeting Jesus returned from death. That beats any barnacle. The other Mary has even more barnacles. In Matthew, she's great. She gets to be Jesus' mother as a teenage bride. As far as I know, she is the only teenage girl in history who reported seeing an angel and it really happened. She goes on to have other sons and daughters, and she gets a bit worried halfway through when Jesus seems to be getting in too deep. She is there when Jesus is executed, and she is with Mary Magdalene at the critical moment of resurrection. That's the digital Mary that you have when you take away the barnacles. As for the rest, our religion just can't leave poor Mary alone. And it wants to give her far too many jobs to do. Jobs, titles, honours, statues. I think she would be appalled at the religious barnacles that have grown over her. But this, even more than Bethlehem, this is Mary's great moment. And with Mary and Mary, especially with Mary, we get Matthew's first Easter egg. Look down at verse 8. This is the kind of thing you don't get in religious books. Holy books, when you read them, go on about light and darkness and souls and things at great length. But look at verse 8. Mary and Mary have seen everything happen. The angel, the guards, the stone. And then in Mary's second encounter with an angel in her life, she gets the instructions, "Go quickly and tell his disciples that he is risen from the dead." So what do the Marys do? Verse 8. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell the disciples. Now, I don't know how old Mary Magdalene was. I think of her as around about 21. But that is just a barnacle in my head. But as for the other Mary, we've got a good history. If she was, say, 14, the time that she first met an angel when Jesus was born, and Jesus lived for around 33 years before he was crucified. How old is Mary now? 47-ish? Mid to late 40s? And in a Roman Empire where average life expectancy is around about 28, 47 is a bit more over the odds than 47 is in the 21st century. 47 might be the new 21 here and now. I'm going to say that because I had a birthday the other day. 47 might be the new 21 here and now. We kid ourselves. But in the first century, Mary at around 47 is seriously getting on in life. Yet in verse 8, what happens? She departs quickly. Then she runs. Forget the horrors of ageing in the first century. How many 47-year-old women do you know who run? Or even jog? You picture it. 47 years old, sprinting through the streets of Jerusalem. That is the picture that pops out of Matthew's little Easter egg here. What makes a 47-year-old woman run? Reality does. This is real. A real angel has come. The tomb is really empty. The angel has really told her the brilliant news that Jesus, who was killed, is back. Isn't that enough to make anyone run? Are you going to treat a bit of news like that with a casual stroll? But there's even more, something more to run with. And that is the second Easter egg. Matthew stores the code in two fragments. The first is back in verse 57. There came a rich man from Arimathea. So what? Look at the second fragment of code, verse 6. The angel's words, "He is risen as he said." As he said? What did he say? Back in verse 63, even the priests knew that Jesus would rise after 3 days, or that's what he said. What did Jesus say? What is the angel quoting from? Well, ever since chapter 16, Jesus has been saying things like this. 16 verse 21. Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. Now, that's pretty dark, and it leaves you wondering like the disciples, but why? Why do bad things like that have to happen to Jesus? What's it all in aid of? With the angel's words, Matthew has sent you on a little hunt through the chapters of Matthew until you find out. But he gives you more in chapter 20. The Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day. And then Jesus goes on a few verses later, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Still a bit cryptic. So Matthew gives you one more in chapter 26. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. Written? Written by whom? Wasn't Matthew, he hadn't written yet. Go back further. Jesus says, written of him. Matthew gives us the Easter egg of a rich man's tomb. Press enter, and up comes a slab of the ancient prophet Isaiah, hidden inside Matthew's book. Isaiah the prophet foretells a character who he only calls the servant of the Lord. The servant in Isaiah is a perfectly good man. God calls him my righteous one, my chosen one, in whom my soul delights. The servant of the Lord is not the kind of character who tells temple guards to lie, or who perverts the course of justice, or tries to secure the execution of innocent people. Isaiah says the servant of the Lord will bring forth justice. And God says to him in Isaiah, I will make you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. That's the Easter egg lodged inside Matthew. But step back for a moment and think about that. The stuff we see in Matthew when the barnacles come off. Religion so corrupt that the police, the priests, plot and scheme to have Jesus executed. Temple guards who tell porkies for cash. A judge who convicts a man he knows is innocent because it is politically expedient. Crowds howling for blood regardless of the rights and wrongs. Disciples who run off in the night, and people weeping and mourning at a tomb. Is that just first century Palestine? Is that just back there 2 millennia ago? Or is that the world as we know it? But Matthew, with his as it is written, points us to Isaiah, who talks about bringing forth justice and salvation to the ends of the earth. Wouldn't you just love to see a bit of that? But if the servant of the Lord brings all that, how? Isaiah the prophet again. Talking, chapter 53, talking about the servant of the Lord. He had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Well, that's Jesus, all right. But in the first half of that verse, they made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death. Rich man's grave, that's Mr. Joseph of Arimathea in verse 57, back here. And the angels, just as he said, and Jesus, as it is written of him, points back to the same thing. Isaiah gives the point of the whole thing. Talking about the servant of the Lord, Isaiah says, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. And Isaiah goes on, upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. The big idea in Isaiah is that the servant of the Lord suffers, but he is innocent. He dies, but he dies in the place of everyone else. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. With the result in Isaiah, my righteous one, my servant, shall make many to be accounted righteous. The servant of the Lord stands in and takes the punishment for other people so they can be counted as totally innocent. Now let Matthew put that together for you with his "as it is written" and his "the Son of Man will be delivered over" and his "ransom for many." Let Matthew put that together for you with his "rich man's grave" and his "he has risen just as he said." And that is not just good news for the two Marys. That is good news on a cosmic scale. That is good news in the face of all the evil the world can dish out. But that is the good news of Easter. The thing is done, and done for all time. The horrors of crucifixion were all about Jesus, the good man, standing in the place of a guilty human race. Now that is so cosmic and so long-lasting that you can have a piece of the action with that. You can line up with the servant of the Lord and trust him and be ransomed and be counted righteous by God himself and enjoy a bit of the salvation to the ends of the earth. You can trust him and have all the good things that Jesus brings. Or you could stick with all the barnacles, obscure the picture, and wallow in a bit of religion. Or you could pass over him entirely and stick with your chocolate and see how long it lasts. Take your pick. Matthew's giving us Jesus from close up, right there in the first century, before any barnacles grew over the story. And he spells out what happened with Jesus and Joseph and the Marys and the rest. And you can read his words and check it out for yourself. Events on Easter morning, so good and so startling that they send a woman in her 40s off on a sprint. And if you want to know what it's all in aid of, Matthew points you over and over again to Isaiah with the servant of the Lord, the good man who suffers for the guilty. And Isaiah makes it all dead clear. What are you going to do? Don't treat Jesus the way these priests do, or these guards, or this pilot. Line up with the servant of the Lord. Take up God's answer to the human problem. Celebrate Easter by trusting the servant of the Lord. Enjoy the Easter eggs embedded in Matthew as well as the other kind. Trust the servant of the Lord and be counted as righteous by God himself, just as he said.